Hello and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And Jem, well, today we're going to be talking, of course, about the Seven Years' War, which you teased on the podcast a little while ago. Now, I know that there are a few wars with sort of numbers in their names. We've got the Hundred Years' War, the 30 Years' War. And what I tend to find, and I'm going with no prior knowledge whatsoever here, which I don't think I need to say in this podcast, but what my big question is the 7 Years' War correctly named, or are you going to tell me it only lasted 3 weeks or something like that?
You're absolutely right. Perhaps my favourite bad name for a war is the War of 1812, much forgotten between Britain and France. Sorry, Britain and France? That's terrible. Britain and America, the War of 1812. The fighting started in 1811. Peace was declared in 1814. And the last battle was in 1815 because it took time to let everybody know in America that it had been agreed in basically Amsterdam. Well, actually, Hague, I can't remember. Belgium. I think it was around Belgium. Anyway, point is, it takes a long time to get from Europe to America. So that's a terrible name. But the good news is the 7 Years' War did actually last 7 years, you'll be pleased to hear. It lasted from 1754 to 1763. And it's completely forgotten. And I find this weird because we talk about World War One. Now, we all know that World War One didn't actually happen across the whole world. Where's South America in World War One? There was a tiny amount of fighting in Asia, but, you know, China wasn't really involved in World War One. So what we mean is a major war that swept across multiple continents. And if you're going to use that as an argument, World War One was certainly not the first global war. You can absolutely argue that the Napoleonic Wars, because you had fighting in the Americas, you had fighting in Africa, and in the Middle East and in Europe. So there was lots of things going on in that. But if you're going to go back further, then I would argue that the 7 Years' War was also a world war. We're talking about, you know, and this was the war that turned, as I said earlier, it turned Britain from an imperial power to the premier imperial power. We had fighting, serious fighting, in North America. We had fighting in India. We had fighting across Europe. I mean, how much more international do you want this thing to be? And we got some very famous people sort of cutting their teeth in this career. We have Nelson. He was a very junior officer during the 7 Years' War. But here's something interesting. Of course, this war happened before the American War of Independence. So George Washington, the leader of the rebellion and, the leader of the army, I should say, and the first president of the United States, was a lieutenant in the English army or British army fighting the French in the 7 Years' War. So I'll just start with that. What do you think of all that?
I think, as you say, the 7 Years' War is very underrated, as it were, not well known for reasons that, as you say, seem quite strange. If you'd asked me before you suggested the topic title and I had a little look into it, if you'd asked me anything about the 7 Years' War, I probably could have got to a war between England and France. That would have been my thoughts on the 7 Years' War. And, of course, you know, it was England or Britain were fighting against France. But it was actually way, way more than that, wasn't it? It was big. It was most of Europe. Most of the big European powers were fighting. And one of the interesting things that I found when I started looking was the way that those alliances sort of stacked up against each other. The interesting thing being, obviously, when you talk about the world wars, you know, couple of hundred years later, or not even 200 years later, the alliances in Europe are entirely different. Because in the 7 Years' War, Britain was sided with Prussia, you know, Prussia and a lot of the other Germanic states, and they're fighting against France. But France is joined up with the Austria, Holy Roman Empire, stuff like that. So you've got what would become the major alliances in World War II are fighting against each other just over 100 years earlier, 150 years earlier or something like that. And I find that incredibly interesting. When we start to look at, especially, take World War II out of the picture, because that's actually more of an ideological war than World War I. But in World War I, where it is still based on control and power, and it's more of a traditional war for gain and over land and territories and disputes like that, I find it interesting that the sides should be so radically different over what is internationally and in terms of sort of warfare in a way. You know, we talked last week about a siege that lasted 21 years. The fact that we've got a 150-year period for all of the alliances in Europe to completely switch and change from a seven-year-long war, I find that fascinating.
Well, you see, I take your point, but I would argue that if you look at perhaps a more recent war comparative to the Seven Years' War, if you look at the Napoleonic era of wars, then actually the sides were fairly similar. And our Prussian ally was somebody that most people have heard of and probably don't realize, oh, right, so he was kind of on our side then, was Frederick the Great of Prussia. Fascinating man. Really fascinating man. And certainly didn't win all his battles, but he won the ones that he needed to. He was constantly fighting. Sometimes, you know, the French were attacking him and the Austrians were attacking him and, Holy Roman Empire, he's having to fight multiple wars all at the same time. And it was his successes on the battlefield in Europe that's kept us, allowed us to keep fighting far afield from Europe. But really, if you're going to be looking at the Seven Years' War, the pivotal year was 1759. And indeed, there is actually a book that I've read, which is cool. Hang on to this, Jim, just pulling it up here. Yes, so it's Frank Maclean, 1759, the year Britain became master of the world. And what's remarkable is, yes, there was fighting in the years before and after, but it was 1759 where Britain just again and again and again kept winning pivotal battles. We now consider British Imperial India as almost a foregone conclusion, but we forget that early on, we were competing against Portugal and France. Now, Portugal kind of waned fairly quickly, but France and Britain, up until the 1750s, were hoovering up chunks of India at fairly similar rates. But it was, again, a name that most people have heard of but didn't realize, oh, this is where he sits then. Clive of India. My father-in-law is also called Clive, but that's not his surname, but he always liked Clive of India, just as, you know, his namesake. So Clive of India was, it was he who managed to defeat a number of not only native Indian armies, but also French-backed armies. So that tipped once and for all favor to Britain in India. So that was a key thing happening on the other side of the world. We then got fighting all over Europe where Frederick the Great just keeps not being finished off by the French and Austrians. And then we go over to America, and again in 1759, that's when we capture Quebec. So we've got General Wolfe. He was a very strange man. He kind of wanted to die in battle, and therefore when he did die on the Plains of Abraham by Quebec, so that's when French Canadian territories become British Canadian territories. And so you can see that there's a huge scope of fighting here. I haven't even sort of, you know, there's a few other cool things to tell you about it, but it was remarkable how so many things in 1759 went the way of the British. And after that, France never really recovered.
So who essentially, you know, let's get the crib notes on this war. Is there a clear winner at the end?
Oh, absolutely. Britain won hands down. They got to keep not all their territory, but most of their territory. So this is why it's considered, you know, Britain and France were at each other's throats throughout this period about building empire. And, you know, let's say in 1740, if you're a gambling man, you couldn't separate these two powers. It's like they are very similarly paced in terms of what they're getting. But then by the end of this war, it was clear that Britain was had overtaken France as an imperial power. Still, they could fight hard in continental Europe, but across the world, Britain was just now gobbling up more colonies and more territories than anybody else. And of course, give it 100 years and you end up with the largest empire the world's ever seen.
Now, if we're in this situation, so the war's being fought in America as well, Britain smashes the whole war home, really shows up their power, everything else. My question with the timing of this war then comes down to, is it anything to do with this war or anything else? How is it that if this war finishes in 1763 and Britain has really hit home, won major victories, and it's taken place in colonial America, how do we then end up in the situation where 13 years later, Britain loses all their colonies?
Well, they only lose the colonies in America. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
So, but the thing is, though, so just shortly before this, Canada was basically French, and now it was British. And indeed, Britain still owned large chunks of America. It ended up being sort of bits of it end up being sold off to the Americans when, you know, it just didn't seem to be needed, as it were. So, look, there, we could do another episode on the American Revolution at some point, but the reality is that at this moment in time, Britain could almost do no wrong. Now, there is, well, actually, you also mentioned, is there a clear winner? Another wonderful little fact is occasionally, very, very rarely, you see the Queen, only on very special occasions, you see the Queen on this colossal gold carriage. This isn't a normal open-top carriage. This thing is literally covered in gold leaf. That was made for George III. He actually came into power in the middle of this war, but that was made for George III to commemorate the wonderful victory over France. So we are still, nobody realizes it, but we're still wallowing in the victories of the Seven Years' War. But there's a bad side as well. I have to tell you this story. So early on in the war, and this is something else you're going to go, really? So a number of the islands in the Mediterranean were British at this point. We'd won them in a previous war. And so we had Menorca. Good holiday destination, but it was captured by the French. So a British admiral, Admiral Byng, that's B-Y-N-G, was sent with basically a bunch of Marines. And the idea was defeat whatever French fleets around there, land, recapture Menorca. So he did engage the French fleet. There was an inconclusive battle. Neither side could really claim outright victory on that one. But because the French fleet was still there, he couldn't land. So he kept sailing around the island, trying to work out, should I land? Shouldn't I land? And in the end, as agreed by all his officers, they went, look, why don't we go back to Gibraltar, refit the ships after the battle damage, get a few more troops, maybe a couple more ships. We'll definitely do this thing. But when he came back to Gibraltar, he was arrested for cowardice. And then he was taken to court. This all rumbled on for a couple of years. But there were the Articles of War. And one of the Articles of War states that every officer must, and this is an exact quote, must do their utmost. So the charge of cowardice was dropped. He clearly wasn't a coward. But had he, as an admiral of a fleet, done his utmost to try and recapture Menorca? And surprisingly, the Admiralty said, no, he hadn't. And so he was taken out onto the deck of a ship and he was shot. He was executed. And Voltaire made a witty comment in one of his plays. I think it was Candide. Don't get me wrong. I don't read a lot of Voltaire. I just know this story and I think it's associated with Candide. But he uses a line going, the British occasionally shoot their officers to encourage the others. And this was, I mean, it shocked everybody. Probably shocked Admiral Byng the most, but it was one of these things where you don't think of Britain sort of carrying out such punitive measures on their very senior officers, but they did. And funnily enough, the next time a British naval engagement happened, this was by a brilliantly named, I know I'm talking a bit, but trust me, this is worth it. We all talk about Trafalgar. Trafalgar was a very impressive battle, but it wasn't done under very impressive conditions. But Admiral Hawke was chasing the French fleet. And the French fleet got lucky because then a storm blew up and they were very near a massive bay on the coast of France called Quiberon Bay, and they had a chance to get in there. And it was in the middle of a storm, and any sensible captain or officer would have said, right, the French, we lost that one. But Hawke pursued in the middle of a storm and attacked the French fleet, completely not expecting to be attacked. Everybody was more worried about the weather than anything else. And he scored a crushing defeat. It was a crushing defeat for the French. I keep doing that. Yeah. So we got a major naval victory. This was one of these French fleets that, you know, if the dice had been rolled another way, they could have possibly used it as an invasion fleet for Britain. So it stopped an invasion. It annihilated a key part of the French fleet. It was a major, major victory. The Battle of Quiberon Bay, completely forgotten by everybody, but there are a number of we don't know what Admiral Hawke was thinking, but a lot of historians think in the back of his mind, if he backs off at this moment, is he going to go the way of Admiral Byng? Has he done his utmost? So yeah, that's conjecture, but I think it puts a smile on the face of every historian going, yeah, that's probably what he was thinking. Anyway, I've just dumped loads of stories, loads of information your way. Hopefully, if you've never really heard of the Seven Years' War before, you're thinking, what sort of sieges in Quebec and battles in a storm? This sounds great. It is. Read up on it.
And it does link to today, because one of the things that I presume, if you go to Canada, there is definitely a big split. If you travel across Canada, you know when you are in British Canada and when you are in French Canada. You know, there is just, it's a very different feeling to the country. It's a very different feeling to the people. Now, don't get me wrong, I think I can safely say every Canadian I've ever met was an absolutely lovely, amazing person. But you do get a different atmosphere when you go British Canada and French Canada. And the fact that we still refer to it as French Canadians and, you know, to British Columbia over there. And you can still see pictures of the Queen in bars in British Canada, obviously not so much in French Canada. And the fact that this is where I love sort of stories from history, and we hear about the battles between the English and the French, and you take it to Canada and places like that. And the fact that you don't have to work hard. A couple of weeks ago, you did a Fast Five about sayings, and yes, you gave us the historical background to various different sayings, and that's always fascinating to learn the history of these phrases, these words we use that you don't really come up, but you have to kind of go a little way. You have to kind of go a little way with it to get from this was what happened, and then it went through, and this is where we get the saying. Whereas when you say there was a Seven Years' War, there was a big battle between the French in Canada and the British in Canada, and today there's still a very different feeling between the two parts of Canada. It kind of doesn't take you a million miles to go from that piece of history to the modern day and how it's reflected. And I think that's always key to history, is, as you were saying in that saying Fast Five, is it being possible for people to see how history has an impact on the world today. And I'm going to go so far.
Oh, no, I would agree. I think that this is the thing. How far back in history depends on how much it affects today. But there can be no doubt that an awful lot of the world's history was altered by the Seven Years' War. Had it gone the other way, then there wouldn't have been a British Imperial India. India would have been split between, I mean, maybe the two sides kept fighting so much that the north of India never fell under the power of either empire. But certainly a big chunk of India would be French dominated. A big chunk of India would have been British dominated. And, I've been meeting recently a number of people from India. And what's interesting is Hindi is the national language. Obviously, yeah, but there are loads of regions. I think there's about 20 official languages, Urdu and Gujarat and all these other ones as well. But the thing is, Hindi is trying to be the glue that glues everything together. But it's very much seen as a northern Indian language. So therefore, somebody in the south, I mean, there's kind of a north-south divide, it seems to me, in almost every country. But in India, the north is seen as kind of the elitists, and the south are like, leave us alone. So they would rather speak English than Hindi. And, you know, a lot of people say, look, actually learning English is vital in India, because even if you learn Hindi, you're not going to be able to speak to everybody in India. But English is the language of the world. So, you know, it's worth learning that at the very least, so we can communicate with America and Australia and Britain. You know, there are major trade partners here that we need to be learning their language. So that would be completely different, because you'd have French in the mix then at that point as well. So, you know, with counterfactual history, it's always very dangerous. But what can be no doubt about it is this, you could almost argue this is the most important era of history that has been the most forgotten.
I would totally agree with that sentence. I was going to actually finish up by saying that, you know, a couple of weeks ago we discussed the Tudors and you thought they were overrated and you completely lost that argument, as I recall. But
I think the votes are still coming in on that one, Greg, but okay.
But I think there is no question of argument here from me, because I completely agree. The more you go into this history, the more impact it seems to have, the more interesting it seems to be, and yet it's not got the sort of acclaim as the Napoleonic Wars, the Wars of Independence, the Wars of the Roses, the First, Second World War. You know, you can name all these wars that people will be able to give you information about. And a 7 years war, as you say, it does just seem to be forgotten. Do you have our last 30 seconds on this gem before we move on to our what if today?
Okay, well, the other thing worth mentioning is that there was fighting in the Caribbean as well. Now, I cannot swear to this because I'm doing this off the top of my head, but I know a number of key Caribbean islands ended up becoming British territories. I think Jamaica was one of them. You know, somebody may want to check that. But the interesting thing, when people talk about the American War of Independence and going, oh, you know, how badly would Britain have been crippled when the 13 colonies was sort of split free? It's like, okay, with hindsight, clearly it would have been a good thing to have what we now call America as part of the British Empire. You know, if we look at, say, the World War One had all that America being part of Britain, that would have been a great thing. But the thing is, the 13 colonies cost more than we got from them. So actually they were a net loss. They were a cost rather than a benefit. And interestingly, the revenues that we were getting from sugar, yes, I am aware we are, of course, talking about slavery here, but if we're just looking at raw money here, the sort of sugar islands of the Caribbean were bigger in terms of money generators, these small islands, than the entire 13 colonies of America. Now, you know, we've done a bit on slavery in the past as well. I'm certainly not denigrating that. But if you're looking at possessions, if you have your mind in the 1700s, that was a major win for Britain. It was a cash cow, basically. So, yes, there is the grubby side of imperialism, slavery, you know, enforcing will on local populations. But in the era of empire, that's the way everybody thought, and Britain ended up being better at it than everybody else. It's also an example where, you know, Britain can fight wars. We don't tend to think of Britain as being, you know, it tends to be the naval engagements. But here we were fighting all across the world, constantly against the French or their allies, and we had a great friend called Frederick the Great, and you know, it's just such a good story. You know, I mentioned that book, 1759. That's a really good one to start with. There is no book out there. I mean, this shows you how forgotten it is. There's no book about all of the 7 Years' War. If you want a book on what was happening in Europe, you can do that. If you want to know what's happening in the empire, you can do that. But no book mashes it all together. And I'm not really the guy to write that book, so I don't think there's going to be a Gems 100 Facts on blah on 7 Years' War anytime soon. And that I'm going to end there. Any other wrap-ups before we get to a what if?
No, let's sneak the what if in very quickly.
Okay. Well, I'm being really cheeky here, Greg. What if the 7 Year War never happened?
Okay, if the 7 Year War never happened, well, the first thing I've got to say is that there would be like this massive gap in the history of the world. There would be this really interesting thing that nobody knows about, and people would all be walking around saying, oh, don't you wish there'd been like a war that we could bring up that was quite interesting if we were doing a podcast and we wanted to have like a really exciting war that's really obscure and people don't really know enough about it.
Should it have lasted 6 years or 7 years, Greg? I'm curious.
Well, this is the thing. Is if there hadn't been a 7 years war, would there have been a 3 years war, or would it have been just a 1 year war? Would there have been a 2 year war? Would there have been a 4 year war? Now, the main thing is that had there not been a 7 year war, this would have been our shortest podcast ever.
Because very true.
We
yes.
would have had absolutely nothing to say in it. And we would have got to the end. The only difference would have been the what if would have been what if there had been a 7 years war. And I'll tell you what, if you had asked me what if there had been a 7 years war, I would not have come up with half of the stuff. I would not, you know, I go on some flights of fancy in my what ifs, I'll be honest. But I would not in a million years have come up with the captain getting shot on his ship, and as a result, the Napoleonic Wars then ending up with another battle being a massive victory for the English because this one guy might have had in the back of his mind that somebody else got shot for not going absolutely crazy and going into battle. What if there hadn't been a 7 years war? Until this morning, Jem, I don't think it would have had any impact whatsoever on my life. But after this last half hour chat, I'm pleased to say I'm probably going to go and find out a little bit more about the 7 years war. So, Jem, just before we finish up, do you have any quick plugs?
Okay, well, do you know what? The closest thing I've done is let's talk about the British Empire and 100 facts. There is a bit about the 7 year war in there as well, because it was part of the British Empire, but it goes on both before and after that era too. Check it out. And Greg, you're going to tell everybody where they can get that book.
Yes, I am. If you go to condensedhistories.com/gems, that is where you will find all the links to all of our books. You can also go to the tour diary on that page and you can find out where I'm going to be performing over the country. And also, it's been out a few weeks now. If you go over to your iTunes, if you want a little bit more podcasting in your lives, then do check out Dinosaurs in Small Bites, my very, very short weekly podcast all about dinosaurs. But for now, thank you all so, so much for listening. We really do appreciate it. Stops me and Jem just talking into a void. Thank you so much to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Deducci.
And thank you very much to my wonderful co-host, Greg Chapman.
And we'll see you all again next week. But for now, goodbye and take care.